anyone who had much association with Thomas Merton, I think, will agree with me that he was such an extraordinarily lively, kinetic kind of human being that we very often have the feeling that his presence is with us. The last time I spoke on Thomas Merton, I was in a hall at Bellarmine College, which was declared in a public announcement not yet dedicated. And the person who introduced me got along just fine. When I got on, the place started, the sound system started squealing, yelling, carrying on. And I remember remarking that that's what comes from speaking in an undedicated hall about a dedicated man. I'm going to, since you have such marvelous coverage of more specialized parts about Thomas Merton, I'm going to do a very simple thing here this evening. I'm going to give a brief background, very brief, about his life and his entrance into the monastery, because I've found that although there are many friends here of Thomas Merton, there are also a number of people who do not know about his background. He was born in the French village of Prades on January the 31st, 1915. Everything about this man who sought to be so ordinary has a slightly extraordinary touch. On the day that he was born in that southern French village, it snowed. It's one of the few times in history that it's ever been known to snow in Prades. There have been sleets and there have been other things, but it snowed that day. The child came 9:30 at night. The child of a New Zealand father and an American mother. His father was an artist, a very fine painter, who at the age of 16 showed such gifts that he was given a scholarship to study in England. He's a man that Merton, although he never knew his father very intimately, revered profoundly. The mother was a Quaker, as I said, from a prominent pacifist family. Since he was born in 1915, it was the beginning of World War I. They remained in Prades, where they had hoped to make their life, because as a gifted painter, but not an established one, his father had to find a place where he could work and where he could live for practically nothing. With the war gaining momentum, his father would have volunteered for the armed services, probably the British armed services, but the Jenkins family, of which his mother was a part, were so adamantly pacifist that there was no question of his ability to do that. They came to America when Merton was approximately 18 months of age and settled in New York State, where her Ruth Jenkins' parents lived. What I would like to do is to correct some of the ideas that have been current. From Merton's own writings, since his mother died when he was only 5 years of age, one can certainly gather the impression that she was a harsh person. A whole lot of people felt that she was very, very advanced for the time. She believed in a certain modern way of bringing up a child. By the time he was 5, Merton could read and write quite well. His mother left a set of diaries in which she charted her son's progress. These are immensely moving to read today, because what they show is a parent who has a great potentiality for love, for care. Both of his parents were like that. They would, I don't know what they would be considered today, but certainly they were of the rebellious young sort of persons. They had met in France, they had married in England, they had moved to Pard, where they lived in tents in the countryside until they got enough money to rent a small house in the village of Pard, where Merton was born. He had an early childhood without any suspicion that there was anything wrong with his mother until he reached the age of 5 and she disappeared. He was told that she was ill. She'd been taken to Bellevue Hospital. And I think his first great touch with a kind of reality that was to acclimate him, if one can say that, was when he received a letter. A letter was handed to him from his mother, in which she told him that she was dying of cancer and that she would not see him again because she did not want him to see her in that condition, and told him goodbye. He remarks that at that age he felt a great burden of grief, not a child's grief, but what he came later to recognize as a fully mature adult sense of grief. Many people, and really interpreting Merton's own writings on this subject, have felt that he suffered a great shock, a great sense of abandonment, that she should take leave of him in this way without anything except a letter to let him know what was happening. She died then when he was 5. She died very shortly after that. His father began to make excursions as a painter. Went to Bermuda, to many places. And Merton, although he was too young to realize what he later felt was a sense of abandonment, was left, while his father made these long trips, he was left with his grandparents and with aunts and uncles. When he was 7, his father decided that this was no good. There had been a brother, John Paul, born in America. He left the younger brother and took Merton with him to France, where he intended to settle. In later life, Merton said that he realized that his father had virtually saved his sanity, that he was in deep misery, and that it had meant everything that his father came and got him, took him to France. The two made the journey. They found a place in the south of France, a place called Saint-Antonin, which is a small village, a medieval village that scarcely changed. And they decided to settle there. They could live cheaply. His father put Merton in the nearest good school, which was the lycée at Montauban, maybe 30, 40 miles from Saint-Antonin. Merton was a boarder in that lycée. It was a horrible experience for him. He loathed being separated from his father, in a country where he knew no one. And he particularly loathed the beastliness and brutality of the young men who attended the lycée, who formed into gangs. After a while, he himself formed the nucleus of a kind of clique, which was at the age of 8, perhaps 9, an intellectual clique. He and his buddies would go out on Thursday afternoons, which was the day off at the lycée, and they would discuss endlessly the novels they were going to write and the novels that they actually did write at that time. At that time, Merton was fascinated by Dumas, The Three Musketeers, works of that sort, and he apparently wrote many incredible novels. His dad, again, who was an extraordinary man, was buying up old medieval shrines. In the old days, they used to make pilgrimages, and these stone shrines would be stations on the way to pilgrimage, and they had now fallen into disuse. And his father bought up some of these and began with his own hands building a house for himself and his two sons. He planted 2 pine trees in the garden, one for each son. Merton would go home on the train between Saint-Antonin and Montauban every weekend, stay with his father. This time he developed an interest in girls, about 10 or 11. I tell you this because in my research, a funny thing happened about it. Apparently, he fell quite hard for a little village girl, and he was always chasing her around a tree. Never caught her. But it got to be some village gossip, and one day he had to face a very stern father. What's this I hear about you chasing that little girl around the tree? And finally, one day, she let him catch her, and he changed his mind. When I went to research in that little village to see the state of the house that his father had built, it was in January. It was a very cold, nasty day. And so I stopped, had a rent-a-car from Toulouse. I stopped in at a bureau de tabac, a tobacco shop, and there was a man in there. And so I asked him, I went in and said, I said, do you know where would be the house built by Owen Merton? And there were some curtains separating the living part of the house of the tobacco shop from the shop proper. And a lady screamed from the back room. She said, Merton, Merton, Thomas Merton. And I said, oui. And she said, she came dashing through those curtains. She was the wife of the proprietor. And I said, did you know Merton? And she said, he was my greatest friend when we were children. She now was approximately 5'2" tall and approximately 5'4" wide. And I looked at her and I thought, you know, instead of researching the life of a writer and a monk and a man of the spirit and a world-famed person, Merton could have ended up being the proprietor of that bureau tabac. And those of us who knew Merton feel that that might not have been too terrible a fate for him. He felt it might not have been too terrible a fate for him. Just when he was ready, when they were ready to move in and settle into this very beautiful little house in Saint-Antonin, without Merton's knowledge, his father was becoming ill, and it was decided that they should go to England. He was sent to a school in England. His father's closest friend from New Zealand was a doctor, Tizard Bennett, who was a Harley Street specialist in London. Merton had been christened one year, in fact, after his birth. Although his mother didn't believe in that kind of thing, the father insisted that he be christened, and Tizard Bennett, the doctor, was his godfather. Merton was sent to an English boys' school, Ockham, where they still remember him. He had been formed as a tough young Frenchman. It was an identification that he never lost to the end of his life. He kept as part of his most cherished self his French identification. He did extraordinary things in a school for one so young. He was a brilliantly endowed young man. He was studying languages. He was writing again his novels. He was a little boy with an immense activity. Then he learned, because his father was not being with him. His father was traveling. His father was this and that and the other. He learned that his dad was in the hospital in London. And he learned very quickly, to his enormous grief, that his father was dying of a brain tumor. That was a second great blow which he suffered at the age of 14. He became the ward then of Dr. Bennett. Dr. Bennett was married to a French wife. They were people of great sophistication. They were well-read people. They were people of the world. Merton says that he learned in that charming apartment, where breakfast was served in bread and bed, and where exquisite lunches were held, that it was perfectly all right to make fun of bourgeois patterns of living, bourgeois morals. In fact, it even amused his godparents. What he didn't, the fine contradistinction that he didn't make, is that it is all right to make fun of these things, to be blasé and sophisticated, but you should not act upon these things. Merton became, in the years of his early teens, again what would be considered a young rebel in this land. He took a rucksack and hitchhiked on all of his vacations in France and Italy, through Alsace. He bummed his way. He incurred more and more the dismay of Dr. Bennett, who felt that he was an irresponsible young man, just throwing away his endowments. He had a small trust fund which had been left to him by his grandfather so that he could barely make it. He developed a tremendous kind of hedonism. He wanted to experience everything. He had no religious sense whatsoever at that point, except perhaps something that was profound and at the unconscious level, which had to do with certain things that he loved about medieval church architecture. But his great adventure was the gratification of every appetite. He tried to become a big drinker. He read all the nasty books that would have horrified his schoolmasters had they known he had them hidden in his locker. And finally, his grandparents sent for him to come and spend the summer in the U.S. His godfather had mapped out a program with his gifts, with his great facility with languages. He was completely bilingual. He thought he should go into the British Diplomatic Corps. So he went to Cambridge, where he made high grades in languages. But he led such a wild life there that he scandalized his godfather. And when he came to the United States to visit his grandparents, his godfather wrote him a very brutal letter, saying he was disgusted with him, that his behavior at Cambridge gave no indication that he could go anywhere in the diplomatic service, and suggested that he remain in the United States, which was fine with Merton. He was glad to do this. He had had, as a highly sensitive person, an extraordinary experience in Italy when he spent the summer there, spent all of his money, and wrote to Dr. Bennett for more. And this had been at a time when he was suffering from a toothache and from sedation, and he had what he believed to be a vision of his father, which certainly had religious implications for him. He became fascinated with the churches of Rome, not for any religious reason, but because of his great interest in the frescoes, in the artworks. But by the end of that summer, he had come to abandon almost everything else in Rome except the church. If anybody was in there, he would leave. If the service was going on, he would not go in. But he felt a great thirst to go in and sit, to absorb the atmosphere in the churches. He had to go back. He had to make one final trip back to England and get his papers in order. And then he came and enrolled in Columbia University. There he became an extremely active member on campus. He was a rebel of the first water. He was also a very gifted man, and he made friendships there that he never lost, and friendships with enormously valuable people. With Robert Lax, with Cy Friedgood, with Mark Van Doren, with Brahmachari. Merton himself has said that he was an awful mess at that time. I never really believed that, because I did not believe that the kind of person that he said he was could make and hold friendships with this quality of human beings. Now that I've researched his life a great deal more, I'm inclined to believe that he was probably right, that he was underestimating rather than overestimating his willfulness, his selfishness, his ego-seeking. Those years at Columbia were years where he made a quite brilliant showing without seeming to study a great deal. He became very, very preoccupied with Blake. Blake was one of the writers first to give him insight. And characteristically of Merton, he tasted things and then would return to them years later and get the full impact of them. Brahmachari, was there at Columbia. Nobody quite knew how. He'd been sent over to the World's Fair in Chicago to do something about Indian religions, and when he got there, the fair was over, and he just sort of wandered around the country and was a marvelous man, vastly amused by everything, and he ended up at Columbia. And through his conversations with Tom became very interested in Indian and Eastern religions, And characteristically of him, he simply went to the library and took out every book at the Columbia Library that dealt with Eastern and Indian religions. And also characteristically of him, he read them all, understanding nothing, as he said, you know, not getting a glimmer out of them. He read them in the translation by a French Jesuit named Vigel. But there again, the seed was planted, an interest, an openness to other religions. And then a key figure appears and recurs again and again in his life. That's Robert Lax. Robert Lax is a poet, man who held a very special place in Merton's heart. It was Lax who, when Merton became more and more dissatisfied with the dead ends that he was taking, it was Lax who encouraged him not to kill the spiritual hungers that were in him. It was through Lax and Ed Rice that he began to take instructions to become a Catholic. After his baptism, he found a certain level of high sensibility to grace, which lasted for a while and then began to fade. But its fading left him profoundly miserable, profoundly unhappy. He would go and spend his summers while he was at Columbia at Olean, New York, with a group of fellow students, usually with Lax and Ed Rice, Siegfried Good, people like this. And they would have novel writing contests. So who could write the novel the fastest? One summer, I think he wrote 3 novels. This was a wild, but quite beautiful kind of a life. It was a little community, long before we think of community life. He took his degree with a thesis, I guess you call it, for a bachelor's degree. What do you call that? It's not a dissertation, thesis, isn't it? On Blake. And he began to work toward his master's. He was engaged to teach at St. Bonaventure's in Olean. And it was there, teaching at St. Bonaventure's, that he met for the first time another person who was to play a key role in his life. And that was Catherine de Houek Doherty, who came there for a talk and just simply overwhelmed him. She's sometimes known as the Baroness, sometimes known as B. She was a Russian lady who came to this country, who was a great mystic, a great hesychast, and who was always getting into trouble. She was very outspoken. She was an extraordinary human being. She and Dorothy Day worked closely together at a time when everyone was suspicious of both of them. She had Merton pretty well decided to abandon his academic career and go and work in her friendship house in Harlem. People have often asked me where Merton's first interest came in problems of racism, problems of suppressed minorities. Certainly his experience with Catherine de Houek in the friendship house in Harlem made a deep and lasting impression on him and gave him the material for some of his most marvelous writings. But this wasn't enough. He was becoming more and more moved toward the total sacrifice of himself for fellow human beings, but not in that sense of social work. In his distress, he was walking with Bob Lax one evening, and they were talking about Merton's frustrations. And he said, "What can I do?" And Lax came out with this kind of remark. He said, "Be a saint." And Merton said, "You know, this is ridiculous. I don't have that kind of vocation." But Lax was he wouldn't stand for any of that kind of rationalization. He said, "You're unhappy, that's what makes you happy." And he began to prey on Merton's mind. And at Columbia, he had met and had studied with a professor of philosophy named Daniel Walsh, whom he respected very, very highly, compared him as a teacher to Mark Van Doren. And he talked with Daniel Walsh about his problems, and Daniel Walsh suggested that he go and make retreat at this Abbey of Gethsemane, which was almost unknown in those days. It was certainly the ordinary layman didn't know anything about the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky, and he went and made a retreat there. And these were the early days of the war. This was in 39, 40. It was at a time when Merton himself was immeasurably horrified at the things he was learning about the suppression of Jewish people in Germany. He had become very interested scholastically. I don't mean this scholastically from the sense of scholastic philosophy, but very interested intellectually in theology and Catholic philosophy from reading Gilson and Jacques Maritain. He saw Jacques Maritain at this time. Jacques Maritain's wife, as you may know, was a Russian Jewish lady. This horror developing in the world through Nazism led him to go and make that retreat at Gethsemane, and it all coincided. And here he felt was the kind of sacrifice that was total, that could command, that was truly challenging. He went back to New York and he wrote the abbot a letter that might have embarrassed him later in his life, in which he said, "You know, this is it. This is the greatest thing I've done, I've seen. You are doing through your life of prayer and sacrifice and contemplation what no one else is doing." And that began to prey on him. He went back to St. Bonaventure's, but he was spending more and more time in prayer and in contemplation, in the approach to sacraments. And finally, he decided that he had a vocation to the Trappist life. He was accepted into the Abbey of Gethsemane, arrived on December the 10th, 1941. One would think that the Trappist rule of that time, for a person who was really a man of the world, who was really an appreciator of the good things, would have been an unbearable shock to him. This was the time when that life was perhaps the most austere life being led by any order. It was not only a life of great austerity, little sleep, much work, long offices, and above all a rule of silence, which was very strictly kept in those days. Long fasts. Meals that consisted in those days of two boiled vegetables, bread, no meat, no eggs, no fish. He took to it with great, almost unbelievable relish. I'm sure that he felt that a lot of this he was doing to join himself with the sufferings of Jewish people. A lot of it he was doing, of course, as a means of fulfilling his vocation as a human being dedicated to God. He went through those first extraordinary years of a life that could be dehumanizing, that he felt, in fact, might very well have been dehumanizing if it weren't made more real and more consonant to human needs. The very end of his life, you saw, many of you, I'm sure, the film last night of his last appearance in Bangkok, put up by Dutch television. It wasn't on that film, but right after that session at noon, he was talking with some of the older Trappists about how hard it was in the old days, before the monastic reforms. And they were pretty much saying that it was almost beyond what humanity could bear. And Merton came out with this remark. He said, yes, but we were happy in those days. And certainly for him, this was partially true. It was difficult for him to live in community. He always said he was not a good community man. It was not difficult for the community to have him live in the community, because he was a man of the most extraordinary courtesy. But what you have to realize is that in those years, and particularly the years immediately after World War II, when there was an inexplicable influx of postulants to the more austere orders. Now, this was before Seven Story Mountain. A great many people have the illusion that it was Merton's books, The Seven Story Mountain, that, as Dan Berrigan said, brought a whole generation into the monasteries. It was not that kind of sequence. His book certainly did have that effect. But this was before he ever wrote that book. When men returning from World War II, or men who hadn't even been in World War II, but who were reacting somehow against the barbarism, were flooding the most austere orders. That abbey at that time was capable of handling perhaps 100, 120 monks. They got up to 275, which meant that they observed the enclosure. They had a little garden so that when all were out in it, you were just jammed together. The rule of silence was an important rule at that point, because, of course, the Trappist ideal is the idea of every man in his own isolation focused on God. And when you're in that kind of a mob, silence, of course, was one of the means of achieving that kind of concentration on God. They had a sign language. They had all of this. But Merton longed. His deepest hunger in those years was a hunger to be alone, a hunger for solitude. In those days, monks slept in dormitories. These dormitories consisted of a little cubicle. I've forgotten what the dimensions are, but probably 5 by 7 feet, with a partition that went down to within a couple of feet of the floor, 18 inches of the floor. And went up perhaps a little bit taller than your head. That was furnished with a cot, which consisted of a board platform with a straw mattress on it and a few nails on the wall. You could put your own little holy pictures up, and you could put your work clothes, nails to hang your work clothes on, and a cloth curtain in front. You were not allowed to be there except during the sleeping hours at night, and by very special permission if you were ill, to rest in the day. So a Trappist in those days was almost never alone. That was before they were even allowed to go out into the fields except to work. You couldn't go out and walk in the woods and meditate. Merton, using what one later came to call holy subterfuge, developed a problem of snoring. And since this is one of the reasons why you can be put off to yourself if you disturb the sleep of your fellow monks, he was given a little room to the side where he could sleep. He also had begun writing. It was known that he was a writer. His health was even then fragile. He had had tuberculosis as a child. He never knew this until he was... In fact, he never knew it until the very end of his life. But when he was in the Dice, he remembered spending a great, great deal of time in the infirmary, and we discovered after his death, or at the very end of his life, that the doctor and his father knew that he had tuberculosis and just didn't let him know about it. But he obviously, he relished heavy labor, hard work. He had a great love for working in the fields. He didn't always have the physical capacity to handle it, although he was a robust man. And so he was given jobs such as going through the entire manuscript collection, which was considerable at Gethsemane. They had an old vault there underneath the stairwell, and he loved that place. He would go in there and he would do all of this annotating, cataloging of the manuscripts and the old books there. And because it had a safe kind of door, a very, very thick door where he wouldn't have any sound, he relished being in there, and he worked in there a great deal. And he more and more came to write. He was given the assignment to write lives of rather obscure saints. It was a work that he was very unhappy about. They were really the old-fashioned pietistic type of books, which thankfully for him were not signed by his name, but just by a monk of Gethsemane. And then, of course, he moved into writing about his spiritual life. Wrote his autobiography up to that point, The Seven-Story Mountain.